For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's I've known Dan for many years, and it's my first time to be in his, home, in a way. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you. I would invite you to kind of relax. I'm not used to talking to people sitting in kind of formal postures. So please relax. I don't know what we wound up with for a title in the publicity. We had a little discussion about this. My preference, it's a way of trying, I'm trying to find a way to kind of encapsulate the Lotus Sutra in a very short period of time. And the metaphor that I like is the two legs and the heart of the Lotus Sutra. Dan didn't like this too well. He wanted sides, I think, two sides. And traditionally it was two halves. The Lotus Sutra was understood to have two halves, although actually it was understood to have two halves and an appendix. So you could say there were three parts. We'll kind of ignore the appendix tonight and talk about the two halves, or the two legs.
Sure.
And the heart of the Lotus Sutra. The metaphor for me works because it's possible to make a kind of comparison to human behavior and human anatomy, I suppose we could say. Both for ourselves, both the legs and the heart are needed. Hi. Come on in.
Please come around. There's chairs over here.
There's some chairs over here.
There's chairs on these sides. Please come and make yourself at home. And please be comfortable.
Human beings need legs in order to get around. The heart doesn't go anywhere without the legs to propel it. And the legs don't get any work done without having some kind of motivation, some kind of heart. And this is true, I think, in English at least, we could say, for the two kinds of hearts that we have. The physical heart, which pumps blood throughout the body so that it can be physically move and be active, but it's also true for the, what we might call, I don't know, the emotional heart, the heart which motivates us, which in classical faculty psychology is the seat of the will, which enables us to get things done. It's the seat of compassion and the motivation for any bodhisattva practice that we might have. So in my way of kind of depicting this, two legs and the heart. The first leg is the many skillful means of the one Buddha vehicle, or the other way around, the one Buddha vehicle of many skillful means is probably a more appropriate way to put it. This is found especially in chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, although traditionally that first half goes from 1 through somewhere into chapter 10, usually chapter 9.5 or something like that. Notice that here, as in so many cases in the Lotus Sutra, we've got an expression of a kind of unity and diversity. And in my view of it at least, which is a fairly standard Tendai interpretation of the Lotus Sutra, in my view of it, the two need each other. The one vehicle can't exist apart from having many skillful means. There's no such thing as a vehicle, as a one vehicle without skillful means, and vice versa. The skillful means are not skillful means unless they are, in some sense, part of what the Lotus Sutra understands to be the one vehicle or the one Buddha vehicle. So I'm going to talk a little bit about skillful means and then a little bit about the one vehicle, and then we'll go on to the second leg. This idea of skillful means, which is to be sure to be found in some other Buddhist texts, but the Lotus Sutra is kind of the locus classicus for skillful means. It's the origin of this very important, especially in East Asia, important Buddhist teaching. I was going to say doctrine, but maybe doctrine isn't the right word here. Maybe best to think of it as a kind of teaching. And skillful means has several meanings. For one thing, it means intelligent, clever, creative, imaginative. In other words, wise. So one of the meanings in the Lotus Sutra of Buddha wisdom is, in fact, skillful means. It's being able to do practical things and have practical effects. The Buddha in the Lotus Sutra never asks for obedient followers. He asks for creative co-workers. And I'll never forget, in the headquarters of Risho Kosukai in Tokyo, there are a couple of Risho Kosukai people here, so I have to mention Risho Kosukai, right? In the headquarters of Risho Kosukai in Tokyo, there are several buildings, among them one called the Dharma Wheel Kaku Guest House or something like that. And there's a large room there devoted, well, it serves many purposes, but dominating that room is a very large image of the thousand-arm Kanon, the Bodhisattva Kanon, which is also here, not in the thousand-arm version, but it's here in another version. And I think I saw another one around here somewhere, maybe.
This little picture of one
over
there.
There's a Kanon over there on the wall.
It's one of the Dobson room, too.
So anyway, there are several Kanons around here. And in this big room of Risho Kosukai, there's a thousand-arm Kanon. And the founder of Risho Kosukai, Nikkyo Niwano, brought me into that room, and we stood there. I won't go into all the decorations of the room. It's an interesting room. And he said to me, you know, in Asia, a lot of people believe that this Kanon is a little bit like a god, and that people can pray to this god for all kinds of favors, and they do. But we believe, speaking off the Risho Kosukai, we believe that that's not correct, that this bodhisattva is really a model for what we can be, not a god to whom we should pray for favors. And in every one of the thousand arms of Kanon, as you probably know, most thousand arm Kanons actually have 42 arms, but and that's what that one has. In each of those hands is a kind of tool, which many people think are tools which Kanon can use to save people. But we believe that if Kanon has a thousand tools with which to help people, the meaning of that is that we should develop a thousand skills for helping others. So Kanon becomes a kind of a model for us of what we can be. So one meaning of skillful means then is has to do with wisdom, but wisdom in a very practical sense of being clever and able to do things for the sake of others. The second meaning of skillful means is effective or successful. Good intentions are good, but good intentions are not good enough. And the Lotus Sutra, every time it gives an example of something it calls skillful means, it's always something that has worked, something that has been successful in helping someone else. So, for example, throughout the Lotus Sutra, there are examples of where Buddha figures, you could even say in a couple of cases, maybe the Buddha himself, tries things and they don't work. So the first famous parable in the Lotus Sutra is the parable of the burning house, where a father comes home, finds his house on fire with his kids inside, and his concern is to get the kids out. And he goes in, the first thing he does, he goes in and he shouts at them, "Get out, there's a fire!" The kids, like my own kids, they don't pay any attention to their father. But the point is, it didn't work. And the father has to rely on some other means, some skillful means, to get the children out of the house. And he does that by promising them something they always wanted. Or the story soon after that, the second parable of the Lotus Sutra is a parable about a rich father and a poor son. This is a story about, most of you know these stories, so I'm just trying to remind you of them. This is a story about a young man who's run away from home as a teenager. The numbers are a little funny. He's been away for 50 years. And he accidentally appears in front of his very rich father's mansion. And the father sends some people out to bring him home. The son doesn't know it's his father, but the father recognizes the son, and the father sends somebody to bring the son home. But it scares the life out of him, and he faints in a road. And they have to send, the father has to send somebody out with cold water to wake up the son, to get him to, and then he, and tell him he can go. Well, again, this is a kind of attempt at something that doesn't work. Or a better, another example might be where there's a father who's a physician, and he carelessly, this is another kind of interesting thing about how careless some of these Buddha figures are. The father physician accidentally leaves some poisonous medicine behind when he goes away on some business. And his kids get into it. We don't know how many kids there are, maybe 5, maybe 50, maybe 500, I don't know. But anyway, the kids get into the medicine, and the father comes home, and of course he's very upset by this, and he prepares an antidote for the children to take to cure them of the poison or overcome the poison which they've taken. And in this case, it's very interesting. Some of them recover. Some of them half recover. They get better, but not completely better. And some of them completely lose their minds. So the father's anecdote partially works, but it doesn't really, it's not satisfactory, so he has to come up with still another solution. In this case, he goes away and sends back word that he's died. And that shocks the children to a kind of, into taking the medicine that he's prepared for them. So the point I'm trying to make here is that for the Lotus Sutra to be skillful means, it has to be successful, has to really work. It's not enough just to have good intentions and to want to help people. It has to be that you actually do help someone. This doesn't mean that unsuccessful tactics are bad or evil or anything of that kind. It's just that they don't work, they're ineffective. And what the Lotus Sutra wants is effective change for the better. In other words, the co-workers of the Buddha have to do the Buddha's work in this world, and they have to do it well. Meditation, which we've just had a very brief exercise in, meditation can be a skillful means, a kind of work, Buddha's work facilitator, making it possible to live better, more helpfully, and more successfully in dealing with oneself and with others. The third implication or meaning, I think, of the term skillful means in the Lotus Sutra has to do with the term means. In the Lotus Sutra, skillful means are just that. They're means, not goals, not ends. And the Lotus Sutra warns us to not get overly attached to the means, even successful means that work for us. That we need to be aware that different things work for different people. Different things may work better or worse in different times. And so it's important to not regard our skillful means, our practices, our teachings, our doctrines, as helpful as they may be, as useful as they may be, we should not become overly attached to them and make them the ends of our practice. In the Lotus Sutra, the end, the purpose of all of these skillful means is what the Lotus Sutra calls the one vehicle or the one Buddha vehicle. This has this one vehicle has two somewhat different meanings. In one hand, one means one purpose, and on the other hand, it means universal. The one purpose is, for the Lotus Sutra, to liberate all the living by leading them into the Buddha way, which is the path or the goal of becoming a Buddha for someone. In other words, for the Lotus Sutra, the goal of all skillful means, the goal of all skillful means is for you to become a Buddha. Now, just a few weeks ago, we were having a Taigen Dan Layton has participated in a Lotus Sutra seminar, which I conduct every year at different places. And just a few months ago, we were meeting in Hawaii. Usually, well, always, it's basically for, it's an academic kind of exercise. And a very famous Japanese professor was one of the participants, and he announced in one of the sessions that it goes without question, it goes without question that the central teaching, the core was his word, the core teaching of the Lotus Sutra is the doctrine of universal salvation. Well, I didn't want to disagree with this famous professor in public, and so I kept my mouth shut during the session. But afterwards, I went up to him and I said, you know, there's some truth to the idea that the core teaching of the universal, of the Lotus Sutra is universal salvation, but that's really not what it's about. The real core teaching of the Lotus Sutra is your salvation. That's what it's concerned about, is what happens to you, not to. And the doctrine of universal salvation, which to be sure is there, the doctrine is only to serve the purpose of motivating you, of having you to understand that you too will become a Buddha. So, the core teaching of the Lotus Sutra, as I see it, is to transform everyone into a bodhisattva. Now, this comes from a particular set of ideas in a particular time in Buddhist history, but the idea is that we need to, that everyone needs to overcome any idea that they may have, any idea or feeling that they may have, that they have arrived and have no more to do. And whether that sense of having arrived is that of the kind of mythological Shravakas that we find in the Lotus Sutra, who think they've arrived because they've reached the status of Arhat, or whether that arriving is a sense of having experienced something in one's head that means one is liberated or free or enlightened or awakened and therefore has nothing more to do. But for the Lotus Sutra, that is the biggest danger for followers of Buddhism. Because all of us, for the Lotus Sutra, need to be on the path of being bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas who are, in some ways, on the path of becoming a Buddha for someone. And so the goal should not be that of being an arhat. The goal should not be that of nirvana. The goal should not be that of enlightenment. The goal should not be that of being awakened. The goal is to be a Buddha. And to be a Buddha in the Lotus Sutra is to be a Buddha for somebody. You can't do it off by yourself in a closet. And that's why in some, not here, but in some versions of Lotus Sutra practice, the Buddha is always, not always, the Buddha is normally a standing Buddha. Again, a Buddha with legs in order to move and be active in the world. So, the second meaning of the one vehicle of many, the second meaning of the one vehicle of many skillful means is universal. And this is picked up on in many places in the Lotus Sutra. It means grand or wonderful or open to all. Chapter 25 of the Lotus, we were just mentioning Kanon a minute ago. Chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra is entitled The Universal Gateway of Kanon Bodhisattva. An indication that it's through devotion to Kanon or Guanyin, it's through devotion to Kanon that anyone can be led to the Bodhisattva path. Or a passage which I often like to mention is the beginning of chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra, a chapter which is largely neglected. This is a chapter entitled Dharma Teachers. In the beginning of the chapter, the Buddha points to the people that are in the congregation in front of him. It's all kinds, monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen, and then a large variety of mythological non-human creatures. So he points to this large mass of living beings, and he says, who among them will be the next Buddha? And he answers his own question by saying, all of them, all of the living will become the next Buddhas. Well, this is a kind of indication that, well, it's kind of interesting. I don't want to talk about chapter 10 very much, but just to mention it very briefly. In Buddhism, as in so many other parts of life, we've got ranks. I'm from an academic life, so we have professors and associate professors and assistant professors and instructors and graduate students and undergraduates. There's a whole hierarchy, and there are hierarchies all over the place. And in Buddhism, generally, we've got this hierarchy of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Pratyeka Buddhas, Shravakas, lay men, and at the bottom, oh, I should have said monks, ordinary nuns, lay men, and lay women. Women always come below. And here comes chapter 10 of the Lotus Sutra, and it just throws all of that out the window. And says, anybody, and it's very careful to remind us, anybody, male or female, monk or nun, lay man or lay woman, anybody can become a teacher of the Dharma. And if you are an effective teacher of the Dharma, you are essentially being a bodhisattva for someone else, without needing the title of bodhisattva or any other title. It's kind of interesting, I think. So the first, I don't mean these in a sense of priority, the first leg of the Lotus Sutra is the mini vehicle, the one vehicle of many skillful means. The second leg, you'll notice that I'm drawing a parallel here, the second leg is the mini Buddha. I'm sorry, I'm getting my numbers screwed up tonight. The one Buddha of many skillful, the one Buddha of many embodiments. The one Buddha of many embodiments. And this is, of course, a tricky kind of teaching. It can be a little bit difficult to understand. It's found primarily in chapters 11, 15, and 16, although traditionally it's understood to begin in chapter 10 and go through 22. Again, there's this idea of a unity and a diversity. Start with chapter 11, for example. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the story there. It's kind of interesting, but what time are we supposed to finish?
Another 15 minutes before the discussion.
Yeah, okay, well. In chapter 11, begins with a stupa of a Buddha named Abundant Treasures, or Many Treasures, emerging from the earth and kind of hanging in the air in front of the Buddha and the congregation. And out of it comes a voice praising Shakyamuni Buddha. Now, there are a couple reasons why this story is very interesting. One is because in a stupa is basically built for the purpose of housing the crematory remains of a Buddha or a famous monk or someone of that kind. So what there should be in a stupa are just ashes and bones. But out of this stupa comes the voice of this many treasures, abundant treasures Buddha. And people want to know what's going on. How can this be? How can a voice come? And the Buddha explains, well, this Buddha, many treasures, abundant treasures, this Buddha promised even before he became a Buddha that whenever someone was really preaching the Lotus Sutra, effectively preaching the Lotus Sutra. He would go there in his stupa to praise him. So that's what he's doing. He's come. And they said, well, if that's true, we want to see this body. He said he would, he promised he would come in his whole body, not just his ashes and bones. He would come in his whole body to praise the preacher of the Lotus Sutra. And so everybody says to him, well, we want to see this. And the Buddha explains, well, he also said that if anyone was going to see his whole body, it would be necessary to assemble the Buddhas from all over the cosmos. And so they respond, the folks respond to the Buddha, okay, let's do it. What are we waiting for? And, I don't want to try to tell the whole story, but, you know, in those days, the Buddha didn't have cell phones or even Morse code or any of those kinds of things. So he sends out a light from a little tuft of hair between his eyes to notify the Buddhas from all over the cosmos. And the, part of what's interesting here for my purposes tonight is that, well, the Japanese word is bunshin. Bun means body, and bun means part, and shin means body. So these Buddhas that are all over the, to be found all over the cosmos, are in some way not very well spelled out. Not spelled out at all. They are in some way embodiments of Shakyamuni Buddha of this world. And yet they're independent Buddhas. They're Buddhas in their own right, with their own lands, with their own periods of effective teaching. And they come to this world after being invited by the Buddha to do so. They're new, well, I better not get into that. They come to this world and eventually they go back home. So there, again, there are many Buddhas, but they are all, in some ways, representatives of Shakyamuni Buddha of this world, of our world. We could say that the teaching here, if we were going to reduce this to a kind of teaching or doctrine, that we could say that the teaching here is that the Buddha, we could even, if you really wanted to be abstract about it, we could say Buddha-ness, or I was glad to see that the recitation tonight didn't say Buddhahood in the Latin. this is a kind of mixed translation.
I think I played with it a little.
I think you played with it a lot. But to good effect. I'm not complaining about that. I think it's much better than the part you, than what you got from Kato-san. Anyway, the idea is that the Buddha, in some sense, is everywhere. But this is not about space travel or something of that kind. It's not trying to present us with either a physical or a metaphysical doctrine. It's really just only trying to address each of us and say to us that the Buddha is wherever you are. There's no place you can go that you can be entirely separate and distant from the Buddha. The Buddha is spatially universal. Another very interesting story in the Lotus Sutra is the one that occurs in chapter 15. And again, it has to do with emerging from the ground. And by traditional Tendai interpretation, the ground is a symbol of everyday human life. So when we understand, we hear that this stupa of this long extinct Buddha, who's still alive, this is another thing that's very interesting, extinct but still alive. This Buddha emerges from the earth. We should understand that this is an emergence from ordinary life. And in chapter 15, it's not a stupa that emerges, but a gazillion bodhisattvas. And the story goes a little bit like this. It's overly abbreviated, but it goes a little bit like this. These Buddhas, well, generally in Buddhism, Buddhas don't travel around without bodhisattva attendants. And so these Buddhas that have been assembled in Chapter 11 from all over the cosmos, they actually come with bodhisattvas. And now in Chapter 15, it's time to go home. And some of these bodhisattvas who come with their Buddhas from all over the place, some of these bodhisattvas are feeling sorry for Shakyamuni Buddha because he's been assigned to work in this world. That's his post, his job. And so they go to him and they offer with some explanation of how difficult they, you know, they basically go to him and say, you've really got a tough job working, being, how did you draw this? Being the Buddha of this world. And remember that in generally in Buddhism, including the Lotus Sutra, this world, the Sahana world, is the world where there has to be suffering, where people have to suffer, and they can. Some people don't always get this right. It's not only that there has to be suffering or that people have to suffer, but that they can endure suffering. Suffering has to be endured and it can be endured. So these bodhisattvas are feeling sorry for Shakyamuni Buddha for being in this world of suffering, and they offer to stay behind while their Buddhas go home. They're going to stay behind and help you out with your tough job. And the Buddha basically says to them, I'm, you know, paraphrasing a little bit here. The Buddha basically says to them, thanks, but no thanks. We've got plenty of bodhisattvas of our own. And out of the earth emerges a gazillion bodhisattvas, countless, numerous bodhisattvas. And of course, again, Maitreya and the others who are there are just, how could this be? Who taught them? How could there be this many bodhisattvas here? Who could have taught them? And the Buddha says, I did. And Maitreya says, well, this is silly. Nobody can believe this. This is like a young man pointing to a 100-year-old man and saying, that's my son. Or it's like the 100-year-old man pointing to a little boy and saying, that's my father. This doesn't make any sense at all. How could it be? Well, actually, Chapter 15 ends on that note. How could it be that there could be so many? Well, the answer to that is that Shakyamuni Buddha didn't just die. Shakyamuni Buddha was not just born some 70 years ago or so. Shakyamuni Buddha, in some way, has been around for innumerable ages and ages and ages. So just as Abundant Treasures Buddha is extinct yet alive, Shakyamuni Buddha also is both dead and alive. Dead in the sense that he's no longer walking around on the earth like a human being, but alive in the sense that he can still teach through the efforts of his bodhisattvas. And these gazillions of bodhisattvas who emerged from the earth in Chapter 15 are understood by the tradition. And I think it's a correct interpretation. They're understood by the tradition to be the bodhisattvas of the future. To be, in other words, you. You are the bodhisattvas who will emerge, who do emerge, who are emerging from the earth, as in from everyday life. Again, this idea that the Buddha is in all time is not a question of, time travel. It's really a kind of, and it's not a doctrine of some kind of universal temporality of the Buddha. It's really a practical matter that the Buddha is always with you, probably closer than you think. And if you wake up, you will see the Buddha in all of those you encounter. In Risho Kosakai and a lot of other Japanese religious organizations that follow the Lotus Sutra or use the Lotus Sutra as their main text, like to use the term eternal Buddha or eternal Shakyamuni Buddha. The term eternal Buddha never occurs in the Lotus Sutra. There's no such term there. But the idea maybe in some sense is there if we don't take this in a kind of Western philosophical sense. The idea is really a kind of what I would call an existential category. The idea basically is that unless the Buddha is embodied in some way, and that's the word you used in this last, for this last sentence of the chapter 16 that we recited, we recited this evening. Yeah, just let's look at that quickly. Let me see what you did right. Which I think is right. I think this is good. How can I cause the living beings, in Chinese text it's got all, how can I cause all living beings to gain entry into the unsurpassed way and promptly embody the Buddha? That's exactly right. Well, you can't say one's exactly right, but it's certainly exact enough. So the idea is that you and I need to embody the Buddha. This is the Buddha way, which is at once the Bodhisattva way, Bodhisattvas being nothing but those who embody the Buddha, who do the work of the Buddha. And in the Lotus Sutra, this is another kind of, you know, neglected dimension of the Lotus Sutra. It says many times that Bodhisattvas do two things. Two things. Transform individuals and purify Buddha lands. I take that to mean that for the Lotus Sutra, Buddhism is not merely about the business of straightening out people's minds. It's about transforming individuals and transforming the world. It has a social dimension, often neglected in Buddhist history, partly because Buddhism has been so often tightly associated with kings and princes and officials of various kinds. The heart of the Lotus Sutra is what is often called Buddha nature. It's a term that the term Buddha nature never occurs in the Lotus Sutra. It's actually found in the Pure Land Sutras, not in the Lotus Sutra, in the Nirvana Sutra particularly. But it is like a thread running through the whole Lotus Sutra without the term, the idea that every single living being, without exception, is capable of becoming a Buddha, is the heart of the Lotus Sutra, unifying it and energizing it. But again, the point here is not a theological doctrine. It's to persuade you, or us, but not collectively. It's to persuade each one of us that we can become a Buddha. The Buddha nature is your hidden treasure. It's a kind of inheritance which can't be taken away from you. At the same time, it's not only in you, it's what you can see in others, for you to see if you wake up. Shakyamuni Buddha, in chapter 12, we learn that part of what makes Shakyamuni Buddha a Buddha is that he can see the Buddha potential in Devadatta, one that everybody knows is just kind of the epitome of evil. The heart of the Lotus Sutra lives, the Buddha nature lives in the one vehicle of many skillful means and is embodied in the one universal Buddha of many embodiments. Apart from these two legs, the one vehicle of many skillful means and the one Buddha of many embodiments, apart from these two, Buddha nature is nothing at all. It just doesn't count for anything. But without the compassionate heart, without the heart of the Lotus Sutra, the legs cannot do the Buddha's work. Both are needed. So please take care of your Buddha legs and your Buddha heart. And I will stop there and open it up for your questions.
Gene, thank you very much for your inspiring and provocative expression. Comments, questions, responses, please. It's a wonderful opportunity.
How are we doing on time? I've forgotten what you told me.
We're fine.
Okay, all right.
If people have to leave at some point, can. There will be tea and cookies after to continue this discussion informally, but let's have some comments, responses, questions. Joe?
No, I don't know that much about foods, but the skillful means cannot be very skillful.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have, for my old ears, I'm going to have to ask you to speak up a little bit.
How skillful are the skillful means? The one that was, because there's not a great number of that, for my knowledge.
Not a great number of what?
The bodhisattvas, people that reached that stage. But I was just wondering, that people that were praying and practicing in the Bali way, their Buddhism, and when you went and saw the temple in Japan, was that a skillful means? And why would that be wrong or not that good or something like that, to practice like that? What I'm getting at is, what is the Bodhisattva? How do you know when you're a Bodhisattva? You said existentialism. Is it values that you now recognize?
Yeah.
As in, you upset your whole part of values? What goes on? What do you feel like? What's new?
Yeah. I think that in the Lotus Sutra, the notion of Bodhisattva is kind of transformed from that of being a kind of a status or a kind of merit badge that you go, oh, now I'm a Bodhisattva. I think in the Lotus Sutra, it's difficult to do in English, but I think in the Lotus Sutra, Bodhisattva is more of a verb than it is a noun. And that that for the Lotus Sutra, not only can everyone be a Bodhisattva, everyone is a Bodhisattva already. And so what we're striving for is not just to become a Bodhisattva from not being a Bodhisattva, but to become more effective in what we do as Bodhisattvas. So its take on what it means to be a Bodhisattva is a little different from the traditional one of achieving a certain kind of rank. And in fact, in classical Buddhism, there are 10 ranks of Bodhisattvas, 10 bhumis. But the Lotus Sutra doesn't, it may or may not, the composers may or may not be aware of that, but they don't use it at all. They really have no interest in these ranks. I don't know if that's addressing your question at all.
Well,
and if the question, part of your question also has to do with how do you know? How do you know whether you've been effective? How do you know if you've done something good or not? And I think the answer to that is you never know for sure. There are no certainties. You calculate as best you can what is most likely to have good results. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we make bad mistakes. Sometimes we're effective. Sometimes we're not. Now, in general, the answer to the question, though, in the Lotus Sutra, is you know you have been doing the Buddha's work when you're effective, when you can see. So, in these parables, for example, the father figure wants to get his kids out of the burning house. The kids leave the burning house. He knows it works. It worked. And the kids are full of joy. And he's full of joy. So joy is also a kind of sign that something has worked. But there's no certainties in this. It's always kind of a trial and error business.
It doesn't matter really whether you're part of it.
Ron, I wanted to just have
Ron?
You chime in. Excuse me, Jeff.
Well, I would like to answer that a little bit from my own personal experience. One of the loveliest experiences I have had as a Buddhist teacher is when some of my students have been reminiscing about things they learned from me years and years ago, and I don't remember saying a single one of them. That was in my mind to try to give, but somehow or another, they got this out. So something worked, something was transmitted.
Yeah.
And at least at that moment, there was some kind of bodhisattva action going on.
Yeah. And it's always interactive. It's not just that you're a bodhisattva,
yeah.
And you can pin a badge on yourself. All right. It's really always a kind of interactive kind of thing. And, yeah.
Does the Lotus Sutra propose anything in the way of means to become more effective in our means? What does it propose as a way to become more skillful in our bodhisattva activities?
The Lotus Sutra is basically a storybook. So it doesn't have a kind of doctrine, but the doctrine I would pull from, I don't know if doctrine's the right word, the teaching I would pull from it is that one of the things we most need is imagination, creativity. What the Lotus Sutra, I think, is teaching us is you come home, you find your kids in a burning house, don't expect you can reach into your pocket and pull out a rule book to tell you what to do when you find your children in a burning house. That book doesn't exist. You've got to come up with a creative solution to that problem and find something that is effective and something that works. So one of the things that the Lotus Sutra pushes on us is the idea of going beyond, or as we now say, thinking outside the box, of using our imagination. And I believe, not everyone would understand it this way, but I believe that a lot of... the Lotus Sutra is full of what we might call hyperbole, huge exaggerations. Just today I was working on a chapter of another book and writing about a bodhisattva in chapter 24, whose name is a wonderful, wonderful voice, or you could say wonderful sound. And I forget the number right now, but he's his height is so many Johannes. And I calculated, there are different interpretations of what that means, but if you took the smallest of them, it would mean that this guy is approximately as tall as 8 times from here to the moon. Tall. And throughout the Lotus Sutra, there's even stories that kind of are used to try to create an image of enormous numbers. Not infinite, but huge, finite numbers. And often we just kind of smile at this and think it's just trying to do something to be interesting. And maybe that's true. But I think there's more than that involved. I think it's really trying to be what we would call mind stretching. It's trying to get us to be imaginative, to be creative. And it's through being creative and imaginative, which is, for the Lotus Sutra, kind of wisdom. This is Buddha wisdom. Is the ability to be insightful and to be creative and imaginative in dealing with problems. So that's what I think the Lotus Sutra wants to emphasize. It's not the whole story, to be sure. It also, I think, there's one passage even where he sort of suggests, to use a modern parlance, that if you're going to be a good physician, know medicine. So it wants us to be skillful in the ordinary sense of being capable. But part of that, part of Buddha wisdom, is being imaginative and creative. So that would be the way I would understand.
Great answer.
Done. The strangest part of the Lotus Sutra for me is part of the inconceivable lifespan, and the idea that Buddha's death is a skillful means. And I've thought about that a good bit, trying to figure out why that could be. And the only, you can probably tell us, the only thing I can think of is that it's a way of saying you can't be a free rider on the Buddha. You can't
be what?
A free rider. He's appeared to go away so that you now have to work on it yourself. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, some people wouldn't understand it that way. I don't. I think that the Lotus Sutra is saying to us that this man was a living, historical being. He was married, he ran away from home, and at least the basic stories that we've heard about Shakyamuni Buddha are basically historical facts. And he died. He ate some bad meat. Died. Was cremated. He's not around that way anymore. But that doesn't mean dead in every way. And now we like to make distinctions. They didn't make the distinction so carefully as we might, but I would say that as a historical being, he's dead and gone and cremated. But he's alive in the teachings, and I have to qualify this word, he's alive in his teachings. And his teachings are perpetrated by today's bodhisattvas. But teachings here doesn't mean only teaching what I'm doing now or trying to. It also means embodying the Buddha's teachings in our daily lives. And if we embody, if we teach by embodying the teachings in our everyday lives, the Buddha is alive. The Buddha is alive for us, and the Buddha is alive for those whom we teach. So the Buddha, it's like this, and already this is prefigured in this story in chapter 11 with abundant treasures Buddha, who it says, constantly says, this extinct Buddha who's speaking to us, who's alive in the present. So the Lotus Sutra wants to emphasize, you know, in, I suppose, I don't know if it's all languages or not, but certainly in Western languages, we try to, we kind of make a very sharp distinction between the past and the present. The past is dead, the present is alive. But the Lotus Sutra wants to say that the past can be alive in us today, and is. So the Buddha can be alive. But here's where I probably am heretical. I don't know. I suspect that for the Lotus Sutra, if nobody teaches Buddha Dharma, the Buddha is no more. We've entered that, what not some other texts have as a kind of fourth phase. You know, you got the phase of the effective teaching of the Dharma, and then you've got the phase of sort of the purely formal carrying on of the teachings, but nobody's affected by it. And then you've got a period of the decline of the Dharma. And then you've got a period when the Dharma is not. And when the Dharma is not, the Buddha is not. And I think that's kind of lying under the Lotus Sutra in some way. Maybe not. It's hard to be sure about it, but that's my guess.
But fortunately, that's not our situation here tonight.
That's, we hope not.
So thank you very much for opening and blossoming the Lotus Sutra for us.